What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Drs. Dubinsky and Stassen. So, Leanne and Annika came on the show today to talk about their book called Women in the Mission of the Church. And y'all, I totally nerded out about this book. It is so good. And really what it's doing is just what it says. It is walking through the history from Mary, the mother of Jesus, to modern times, and just talking about how women operated in the church, the sort of work that women did in the church, and how the church, frankly, depended on women throughout much of its history and still does today in a lot of respects. And this is just the sort of history that we don't get, and it is such important history for us to learn. We talk about even how we think about Mary, the mother of Jesus, and then how that work goes on through women in mentorship roles to people, to men doing theology, and what it looks like for women to operate in this world and to do work for the gospel. And so you are going to get so much out of this. We just do a flyover. We could not even do this book anywhere close to justice. And we fly over the history of women in the church, but I think you see such important themes of how women have been treated throughout the years, and the consistent, you know, patriarchy that has kept women from the full potential. And I think there's just so much to learn here. This is so good. Before we get to the episode, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle, and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with the podcast and hear my random thoughts. It's super fun. And if you enjoy this podcast, I would greatly appreciate a rating and review on iTunes. Helps get the word out about the podcast. That would be greatly appreciated. So I hope you really enjoy hearing from Annika and Liam. Okay. Well, hey, thank y'all for coming on the show. I am excited to meet y'all and talk through the book a little bit.
Yeah, we're glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Certainly. Yeah. Let's just start off. How about we do each of you? I'd love to hear a quick sort of intro, just background, like what you do, work, before we sort of jump into the book proper. Does that work?
So I'm Leanne. I teach in the doctoral program at the Cook School of Intercultural Studies at Biola University. And I'm also associate dean there. And I work mostly with doctoral students on their dissertations, supervising their research, helping them figure out what they want to do and how they're going to do it. So it's a blast. I love doing it.
Mm-hmm. Love it. And I'm at Indiana Wesleyan. I'm Annika Stassen. I met Leanne when I was at Biola for 2 years working in their honors college. And then I came to Indiana Wesleyan to work here in our honors college. And so I teach one of the history classes that the students take. And then I also teach an ethics class kind of related to food. Where food comes from is another huge interest of mine, along with gender and the history of the family. And my husband and I actually have a little hobby farm, and we try to grow as much food to eat as we can. So that's another thing that we do.
Mm-hmm. I love that. That's awesome. Yeah. I did some farming back in the day. Cool. That's good stuff. Yeah. Well, so we're here discussing women in the mission of the church, right? The book that you have co-authored, which is just incredible work. I was telling you beforehand, I got a lot out of the book, to be honest with you. And I think it's important work. Can y'all just talk a little bit just about the sort of genesis and like where the idea for talking about women in the history of the church kind of came from?
Yeah. Well, earlier, Curry, you said that in your own studies, you didn't really hear very many stories about women's contributions to the church. And in my Master of Theology program, I didn't either. And later in a Doctor of Ministry program at Gordon-Conwell, I started to hear little stories here and there. I got a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it piqued my interest. And so when I was asked to teach a class on women in leadership for Cairn University, which is in Pennsylvania, I thought, I want to show how women have been involved in the church from the very beginning. And so I did some more research, and I developed this presentation that looked at basically three big eras of the history of the church. So the early church, the monastic movement, and then the missionary movement, just to try to paint this sort of bird's eye view of how women have always been involved from the very earliest times in the ministry of the church. So I taught that presentation for that class. And then a few years later, I started giving it to conferences with missionary women and women in mission leadership, and they loved it. And pretty soon they started asking me, where's the book? Where's the book? And I thought, oh, maybe there should be a book. And then I thought, I need a historian to help me write a history book because I'm not trained in history. I'm trained as an educator. So I contacted Annika, who we had met at Viola, and said, hey, is this a project that might be of interest to you? And she was in. And so that's how we got launched.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's so fun also just that we got to do this together. Because it was a great chance for us to be able to share some of our own experiences of growing up as women in the church, and also kind of which women in the history that we were drawn to. One of the things that I had seen as a historian was that historians for, you know, 30, 40, 50 years have been reclaiming the stories of women, but they just haven't really made their way out there into the general public, especially in our seminary education or our undergraduate work, or just people in the pews or people in missions. So that was really our vision for this book. Like, we're not really doing anything new here. We're just pulling these stories and making them accessible in a kind of one-off, here's a book you could buy that you could read many stories from different eras. So trying to make that great historical scholarship available just to average people out there.
Yeah. I love that. And it's interdisciplinary, right? I mean, you get a lot of depth from the book, I think, because of that. So that's cool. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we're talking about the women's stories of women, right? And I think the best part about all, I think the best thing we could probably do is like sort of talk through some of those stories. And so I'd love to sort of maybe walk through the book a little bit and highlight certain places. But I think I want to talk about first where y'all start is amazing, and that you start with Mary, right? I think for Protestants in general, and then evangelicals in particular, Mary just sort of is there at the beginning and then is over. And for the vast history of the church, that has not been the case. So can y'all just talk a little bit about just even this starting point with the Mother of God?
Yeah. Yeah, that's been something I've been really interested in too. Like you said, as a Protestant growing up in the church, it's like, there she is, you know, when the little kids put on the Christmas pageant, and then the rest of the year, you never even talk about her. And so growing up as a woman, and then also growing up and having several really close Roman Catholic friends, for me, that was where I got in touch with Mary and how important she was in their faith, in terms of being a model woman, but also being just a model Christian, someone who follows Jesus. And so that dynamic was really impressive to me too, thinking about, well, here's the woman that carried Jesus in her womb, like the God of the universe. She carried him in her womb. Like, can we please just stop there and note how incredible that fact is?
Right.
You know? And so, yeah, if you're going to start anywhere when you're talking about women in the church, you've got to just start there. What was that like for her? What does that tell us about who God is and how he values women's bodies? And he values this procreative capacity of women's bodies. But also traditionally, you know, when Mary is thought of as a celibate woman, you know, she was a virgin. So I think Mary is also a fascinating figure for me because of the way she celebrates both women's motherhood, but also this other role that women and men can have, which is to be a celibate follower of Jesus. So I like her for many reasons.
Awesome. Yeah, I think well, this is one of my soapboxes, but I'll go here anyway.
Do it. I want to hear it. Go.
Well, I feel like our loss of Mary speaks to our loss of just the full humanity of Christ in general, where most of us are maybe borderline on heretics in the way that we actually view Jesus as fully God, but not necessarily fully human. And some of that is because of this loss of, like, he was actually born to a woman and was a baby, you know, like in a womb. And just the helplessness that, like, the dependency he has on Mary in the womb and growing up, it just doesn't come to the fore of our minds, I think, enough. So,
Totally. Yeah. I love to think of him too. And again, scripture doesn't give us a ton. Like, we don't have a ton of stories about him growing up. We kind of just get, she gave birth, and then, you know, when he's 12 and he's in the temple and she and Joseph can't find him. And it's sort of this like frantic mama moment where you can't find your kid. And then of course you're kind of mad at him. But like in between those years, just thinking of him growing up with a mother and with a father who was a carpenter, and learning about the life of faith from his parents. I like to just kind of imagine that life and what that must have been like. And then you think about the kinds of stories that Jesus tells later in life, even like the mustard seed or the grain of yeast. And you can kind of imagine him like watching his mother bake bread or, you know, watching these other activities around the household. And I think you're right, Curry, that it does help you to imagine him as a child, as a person, you know, just to put yourself there to appreciate his humanity.
Yeah, I think it's important stuff. So good. Okay, so let's then start our journey here, I guess. I mean, we have 2,000 years of women's work in the church to kind of cover. How do you start seeing the early progression of like sort of how women how women work in the church, and then how that sort of transforms as we move into like a Constantine and sort of, you know, where the church becomes a real presence, I guess, in the world?
So in those early presentations that I was doing, I focused really strongly on widows, virgins, and deacons, because we can see each of those in nascent form in the New Testament. And then as the church began to grow, we see all three of those kind of develop into actual ministries, official recognized ministries of the church. And so one of the stories I like is Dorcas, right? We all know the story of Dorcas. She was sewing clothes, and she died very suddenly. And all the widows who were working with her sent off to get Peter to come in, and Peter raises her. And from this story, we see that she was making clothes. And from what we can tell, it was for poor people in the church. It was part of the church ministry. She wasn't just making her own clothes. And as we see the order of widows develop, one of the things they do is caring for the poor and the needy. And so we see that presented here in the New Testament story. The virgins part, we also see beginning to take place in 1 Corinthians, where Paul's talking about it's better to perhaps to stay single. I think another area that the Protestant church has really maybe lost some of what would benefit us is this extreme focus on marriage as the way to follow God. And we kind of have lost sight of the value, as Annika was saying earlier, of celibate life that follows God. The Catholic church has done better with that than the evangelical church has, to our, or the Protestant church, to our loss, I think. But we see that starting in the New Testament, and then we see how it develops all the way up through the Middle Ages with the monastic movements. And then we see patrons. We see women who had the church in their house and hosted it. So Lydia is a great example of that, right? The merchant of purple cloth, and she meets Paul and brings him back and hosts them in her house. And Paul names other women in his letters who hosted the church. And then we also move into martyrs, and I think I'll let Annika talk about them, because that's really the area where she dug down into that she brought that was kind of not in part of my original thinking about these early church women.
And that comes out of, I teach a class here at Indiana Wesleyan, and we read this woman's journal. Perpetua is her name, and she was a high-born Roman woman around about the year 200, and she became a Christian. And this was seen as a slam on her family. Her family was not Christian. She ended up being arrested, put in prison. And so we actually have this prison diary that she wrote. It's one of the biggest pieces of literature that we have from a woman in this period. And she also had an infant son at the time. So she's in the prison cell nursing this baby, writing about what it's like to be there. God sends her a vision, four visions, in fact. So I have my students read this, and then we just talk about the way in which Christ totally transformed this woman's identity. Like, her whole point was to bear an heir for her family, to be a wife and mother, and she basically gives all this up to be a martyr. You know, she follows Christ to death. And so obviously she's celebrated by the Christians as being an exemplar of the faith. Like, look, here's someone who demonstrates to us what it's like to follow Jesus. And there's many women and men like this in the early church. And I think this is an area that we do know about growing up in the church. You know, there's martyrs. But you also don't realize as a Protestant that it wasn't just their one day martyrdom that they were celebrated. Like, no, the church every year would pull out these people's stories and say, look, here's someone for us to look to as a model of faith. And so when you think about the way in which some of these people impacted the church, their impact took place over generations as people learned their stories. So I, as a woman, I just love thinking about her. What was that like? How did she get support from God in the midst of the prison cell? And one of the things is so cool. He gives her this vision. And basically in the vision, this shepherd figure feeds her some cheese. And when she wakes up from the vision, like she still kind of tastes the cheese on her tongue. And you can interpret this as in a way like God feeding her like Eucharist and equipping her for this task that she is about to undertake in terms of going to the arena to be killed. So there's many interesting parts of this diary. So I would recommend it to anyone just to read her diary from that period.
That's awesome. I'll link show notes to that.
Cool.
So yeah. People can find something like that. I love that. And yeah, a couple, I guess I have too many thoughts swirling in my mind right now, but I think first, when you're talking about the early period of the church, I think it is easier to see the disconnect we have historically and culturally from the early Christians. When we talk about widows and like their role in the church, and like, that's just not something we deal with on a regular basis, I guess. And even of course, martyrdom, right? Like American Christians don't deal with that sort of stuff. But like these women were serving in specific instances, like as virgins and, you know, in celibacy. And we just don't have, not even do we not have monasticism in our culture, but we don't have like, oh, those offices aren't for us as well. And so like I guess the culture of that early church can feel very foreign. Would y'all agree with that?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Mm-hmm. For sure.
It feels very far away in some ways to where we are today.
Yeah. It's almost a different Christianity in some ways or something.
Almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I love how you highlight the roles that these women are playing, like in this early church and the ministry that they do, you know, as officed, you know, like this is an office
right.
that they,
it was an office.
Right. Right. I think that's, mm-hmm. I think that's important. Mm-hmm.
Stuff, and, so. And along with that, it had the honor and the respect and the authority, like people looked up to these people. Often those widows and those virgins, consecrated virgins, they would sit in the front of the church. You know, right. They were recognized by people as, these are people we could talk to. These are people that could pray for us. These are people that could give us ideas for how to live out the Christian life in our own sphere. And so maybe something like that is more accessible to us, because a lot of our churches will have like a little prayer time at the end of the service, like go to this person who's stationed on this side of the church, you know, they're available for prayer. So I think maybe things like that could be a tie to the contemporary world.
I think you're right. I was just thinking of the woman that anytime I have something going on in my life, I immediately go to have her pray for me, you know, mm-hmm. So it's always going to be spirit inspired and it's always going to be what you needed to hear in the moment, I think. So, yeah, I think that's helpful. It's good. Okay. So as we move into Christianity becoming sort of a mainstay religion, Constantine, the Edict of Milan goes out, right? And now we're starting to form theology, like coming up with basic doctrines and that sort of stuff. And I had never heard of a woman's role in that period of time. Like I've done a lot of study. I mean, that's a heavily studied part of this theology, right? Never heard of a woman's influence in any of that. So can we please highlight how these women sort of start early theology?
I think one of the women I wanted to highlight too was Constantine's mom, because she is right there beside him. I think early on when I was doing this research, I sort of figured, oh, his mom, Helena, was a Christian. That's probably how he became a Christian, right? Well, no, we don't actually have evidence of that. We don't totally think that's what was going on there. But with Constantine becoming the first Christian emperor, his mother, after she does convert, also kind of creates a new role for women in terms of being an empress. So that's someone who's often either the wife or the mother or the sister of the emperor, and they do have authority. They're often credited with like doing building projects or demonstrating what piety looks like. And so she definitely fulfills those roles, but specifically as a Christian. So she helps to cast this vision, just as Constantine is casting a vision of what the Christian emperor looks like. She's casting a vision. And as an 80-year-old woman, she goes on this pilgrimage out to the Holy Land, but it's not just I want to go see the holy sites. She's also this diplomatic messenger for Constantine, and she's helping to kind of return property to Christians, to build churches, to free prisoners who'd been imprisoned during anti-Christian movements. So I think she's an interesting person to talk about.
I kind of liked Anthusa, the mother of Chrysostom, and the way she worked with her son, right? And yeah. I've seen this for many years, and this is maybe a slightly confrontational thing to say, but it feels like when history is written by men, men just look for the other men and kind of don't see. It's like the women around the man are invisible. And so the credit gets all given to the man. And what we've tried to do is say, there's a lot of people who were involved with this particular man's development as a great thinker. He was influenced by his mother. He was homeschooled by her. He was discipled by his sister who prayed for him and argued theology with him, right? We show these different cases. Yeah. And it doesn't, in my mind, it doesn't diminish at all the influence of the man. But what it does do is remind us of this beautiful picture of what God set up originally, which is the man and the woman are better together. Mm. And when we see that picture of completeness, of wholeness of the two of them or three of them or whole family sort of working together, it helps us have a healthier view, I think, of relationships in the church and of how things work. Instead of putting all the pressure on one person to be the answer to everything, right? We can see the fuller knitting and weaving together of how it all works. It's a little bit more big picture and less specific story about a particular person. But I think that's one of the things that we sort of unpacked throughout the book.
Yeah. And it was much appreciated. Like those are just the stories you don't hear because those go, it's a little more in the background even, you know, right. Which is the harder work in some, some respects, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's really hard to tell, for example, like with Macrina, who's Gregory of Nyssa's sister, and he writes these books where he depicts her as the wise philosopher and him as kind of the student learning from her. And she's the oldest of 10 children, or mm-hmm. the oldest, you know, and so her younger brother, she's there having those theological conversations with him, helping. But she didn't leave behind stuff that was written. And so it's really tricky. That's what's so hard in trying to tell these women's stories. Like, well, how much in what Gregory of Nyssa wrote in On the Soul and the Resurrection is like him depicting her, but it wasn't really her, but how much is really her, you know? And so people do that difficult work and make arguments about that. And we're not trying to get super nitty gritty on it. We're just trying to say, look, he clearly learned from his older sister. They clearly had theological conversations that shaped their family, that shaped him as a bishop in the church, and that therefore shaped the rest of the church's theology that developed. Like, we're just trying to bring up that voice.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's helpful. I guess it's just hard to like, yeah, like these women did incredible, important things. So I guess from your reading of how this ebb and flow happened, right, where the offices of women and the importance of women, even to these men, how does the role of women, and I know we'll get to this in the Reformation. Sorry, this is like a big overarching question, but how does this ebb and flow like, What's with the devaluation of women? Maybe I could just ask that. Like, is that too big of a question?
No, that's
like approach.
I think that's a really good question.
It's a great question.
I mean, I always like to I like to pin it on Aristotle. Frankly, okay. I think that's a helpful.
That's where I was at too.
But yeah, it's just a helpful place to go because it's like, look, this was just the Greek thinker that everybody in the time read. And he clearly saw women as inferior to men. He had this super weird, you can read about it in many of his works. Basically, women, it all boiled back to the fact that women don't have sperm. And so this was like the number one factor that made women inferior. And so they were inferior. They were actually deformed men, is what yeah. they were. And basically, it was a man's job to do all the thinking, because while women had rational capacity, their emotions always got in the way of that rational capacity. So they just couldn't be trusted. Women, however, though, were better off than slaves, because slaves didn't have that rational capacity at all. So at least women had it. And so like we hear this, and we just have to realize that this is what all the church leaders are reading in the time. And they're also reading all kinds of other literature that depicts women as less thoughtful than men, more carnal, more easily tempted. And so there's just in this cultural Greco-Roman cultural milieu, there's just those are the ideas about women. And so to think that the church fathers wouldn't be influenced by that at all is just not realistic. But then you also throw in the stories of Jesus interacting with women. And, you know, anytime Christianity enters a new cultural frontier, people are shocked by that. They look at Jesus interacting with women and they're like, wow, he treats women differently than the way women are treated in our culture, you know? And so the church fathers do have that in their head too. And so there's both. And so I think that's part of what's going on here.
Well, and then I think sort of even bigger picture on a pragmatic level, what happens is then it kind of becomes a chicken and egg problem. Because if the teaching is that women aren't rational and they're not capable, then women don't get education, for example, or they don't get provided with the means to write down what they're thinking about. And so then, of course, they continue to appear less competent and get less education, and then they're credited as being less capable. And it just kind of becomes this spiral, which is really hard to break out of. And we see that repeated, you know, all throughout the history that we look at.
I think, yeah, that's helpful. Can I just say for a second, that is so stupid, like that women are deformed men. That is just dumb. Like, women's bodies are the only ones that can actually do anything like really beneficial, you know? Like,
I know. Every time my students read it, they're like, is this guy for real? Like, well, yeah, I mean, he's going on what they had access to, and these were his ideas.
And it, I guess it's just hard to think that, like, the truth of, like, men and women both being created in God's image, like, couldn't win out over that cultural thing. And not only for, like, a period of time. I mean, we're talking, like, for the vast majority of the history of Christianity, that truth has not come to the fore, you know?
I think one of the other things that I see going on, like I was saying about the stories of Jesus interacting with women, and people who have not been Christian read these stories and they're so shocked and they're like, wow, this is a completely different worldview. But then you have to have all the missiological questions about, okay, now what do? We have like a small group of Christians that are really compelled by this vision, the egalitarian vision, like slaves and free and male and female and old and young and like everybody kind of here. But it's offensive. Like, that's a pretty offensive message to like the Roman Empire or whichever culture you happen to be in. And so then you have to ask the question of like, well, should we tone down some of these egalitarian messages just so that it helps our message to be able to appeal to those high class Christians, you know, or those high class people? You know, we don't want to scare them away from the faith totally. And so I do kind of end up seeing kind of a capitulation to the culture many times with the aim of trying to grow the church or in the time.
Cash rules all.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So I think that's also is what's going on in a place where women end up getting the bad end of the deal.
It's frustrating. Okay. Well, this I think is a great, leads us into one of my favorite parts of the book, my personal favorite, which is the mystics.
Cool.
Because you see these women kind of do whatever they want to and end up like basically getting themselves into leadership positions, like, without going through the system, sort of. I've always loved the mystic tradition. I think it's like really cool. I think like hearing from the Holy Spirit's important. And I think that especially this is where you really start to see women developing like theology and that sort of thing. So can you all maybe just introduce what even like mysticism is in general? And then maybe we could dig into some of these stories, I guess.
Yeah, sure. And so mysticism, at least from what we talk about here, it's like when someone, you know, sees a vision. And most of the time, they aren't like having a dream in mysticism. Like, that's the differences between dreams, like someone falls asleep. A mystic is actually awake. But all of a sudden, like maybe you're going up for communion, but then all of a sudden, like one of these mystics, Hadovich is her name, like she's going up for communion. And then all of a sudden, like it's Jesus up there instead of the priest. Like, this is the visionary aspect. And so everything else that's happening around her kind of fades away and it's just her and Jesus. And then Jesus in the vision ends up feeding her the Eucharistic elements. Not only that, but she like gets a hug from Jesus. So awesome. So cool. But then it's sort of over. Jesus kind of fades away. She wakes up. But, you know, again, she wasn't asleep. She was awake. But the vision is over and she kind of comes back to real life and everybody's like, clearly something just happened to you. Please tell us about that because you look crazy. And so then she's telling the other people gathered, you know, this is what just happened to me. Or, you know, other times someone will like hear a voice or just see a light. So it's these kind of mystical phenomena where they're seeing some kind of picture or hearing a voice from Jesus or hearing a voice from an angel. And then what happens is they tell their story and they're trying to kind of make sense of what is it that just happened to me? What am I supposed to do with this? How does this contribute to my own understanding of God? How does this contribute to other people's? Is it a message of comfort? Is it a message of warning? That's kind of my sense of what's going on, at least with these medieval mystics, which, I mean, I compare them. I don't go to a charismatic church, but I've been at a couple of events where, you know, somebody will get a word from the Lord and they'll come and say like, hey, I sort of, you know, had this word from the Lord for you, or I had this image come to my mind. I wanted to give this to you. So it's like similar to that. Like it's for this individual woman, but then she ends up kind of sharing the image as a way for the church to learn something.
Right.
And that last piece feels like the really important part of all of this. For some of them, it was very much about personal encouragement, but they didn't keep it to themselves. It became something that was for the good of those around them as well, right? So it was, sometimes they were discouraged, right? They would come out of it and then they would feel sad or disappointed or frustrated that they'd lost that closeness. But the point of it wasn't for their own personal benefit so much as for the good of the community around them.
Yeah. Well, and people listened, right?
I mean, and people listened. Yeah.
It's cool. Yeah.
But it's super risky. Like if you think about it, if you're a woman in this period, so we're talking from like 1000 to like 1300. Somewhere in there. So like Hildegard is one of the early mystics in this period. And she knows that if she shares her visions, and she's someone who actually got very specific visions, like you can check out books on her and actually see, she then wrote, she drew them out, what she saw. And then she like wrote down everything that the voice told her. And then she wrote her own interpretation of what she thinks like the voice was what all this means. But she knows that sharing that is going to be seen as lifting yourself up as a woman, doing things that are considered inappropriate for you to do. She knows she might be seen as a heretic for teaching things that are outside the bounds of the church. Yeah. So she is super smart in how she handles it. First of all, she's kind of scared. She doesn't want to do anything for decades. She keeps it all to herself. But then she's like she gets sick and finally becomes convinced, like, again, she hears the voice, like, you need to share these for the sake of the church. And then she finally does share them with one other. She's part of a double monastery. So there's men and women in different parts of this monastery. So she shares it with one of the men. And he's like, Hildegard, this is amazing. You've got to tell everybody. So then she sends it to Bernard of Clairvaux, who is a monk at a different monastery, and he's one of the most respected men in Europe. And so that was a risk. But as soon as she gets Bernard telling her, yes, you need to share this, then she's kind of good to go. And then it gets sent to the Pope, and the Pope also gives her permission to share. And so then she's able to share these visions, put them out there for the church to view. And a lot of her visions are, kind of to call the church back to faithfulness. She is someone who's interested in reforming some of the abuses of the church at that time. But you can see with all these steps she had to go through, like kind of a tricky situation that she's in. And she constantly talks about, I'm just a poor little woman. If you read her writings, I'm just a feather on the breath of the wind of God. Like she's constantly trying, because to see what she's doing, like as this crazy mystical visionary woman, like she has to kind of keep downplaying herself and talking about her sinfulness so that people, you know, in part because she really feels that way, but also in part to protect herself from
being strategic.
It's strategic. It is. But my students are always wanting to be like, it's not just strategic. She also, like, you're right. It's complicated.
Sure, it's both.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. I like that. And yeah. Not to make it like the mystical tradition so like rosy, I guess, but I mean they were certain ones were persecuted, right? For some of these things and put in prison and that sort of thing, right? So
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what's so interesting. Like, why do some of them get persecuted, burned at the stake? Marguerite Perret, burned at the stake. Mm-hmm. Well, right. In part because she doesn't have the protection of a monastic community. Like, right. Hildegard's in a Benedictine community, and some of these other women are in a community, but she's just out there. She's a beguine. These are women that aren't necessarily confined within the walls of an enclosed monastery. They're more just like in a house together, living the Christian life. So it's more risky for her, and she's seen as being someone who's leading people astray. And so the church, to protect people, you know, has to get rid of such teaching, and so they burn her at the stake. So yeah, you can see how it's really risky what they're doing, but also that it is this way that women are taking a leadership role by sharing what they believe is God's teaching for a given time period.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I mean, we haven't even really like delved into the whole monastic tradition and nuns, which are like a huge part of this all, right?
Yeah, this was one place that was interesting to me, because really it started with the Desert Fathers way back, even just before Constantine, where they were saying, you know, the church is getting, Christians are getting too interested in money and authority and power, and we got to get back to the roots. And so we're going to go out in the desert and we're going to live by ourselves. And I think I kind of grew up thinking that was just men, but it really wasn't. There were desert mothers as well. There were women who were doing the same thing, going out, living in the desert, trying to restore that simple life. And that tradition just continued to build throughout the Middle Ages, of women feeling this call to a more simple life. We talk about the growth of the middle class and how that more money and more things began to feel burdensome sometimes to people, and they wanted to restore more of the simple Christian life, and how women flocked to this. This calling, right, to follow God, to follow Christ, to live a simple life, to be devoted. And at various stages in the history of the church, there were so many women that there were no place for them, right? They were founding houses and new houses and joining faster, and the men didn't know what to do with them. And so the men would try to slow it down, right?
Yeah.
But the women had this call and they had this passion, and so they went.
Yeah. That's cool. I love, yeah. I really nerded out about this book, if you can't tell, but I love all that. I think it's cool just like knowing how like people walked their faith faithfully in the past. You know, I think that's cool. So, okay. So for us, as you know, as Protestants, we move into the Reformation, right? Which changes significantly, doesn't it? Like some of the roles of women and how even women are viewed. Can we talk about I guess I'm kind of putting all the pieces together, I guess, for myself, because, right, you have the Renaissance, which is this look back to like some of these early things going on in Greek philosophy and whatnot, right? As the Reformation comes out of sort of that Enlightenment sort of Renaissance period, do we delve back into sort of this Aristotelian sort of Greek way of thinking in some respects?
I mean, I think that was just the thinking all the way along. Like this whole period that we've been talking about thus far, in general, women are thought of as lesser than men, more susceptible to temptation, more carnal, more sinful. Like that's just the constant. That piece actually doesn't change until the 19th century. And in the 19th century, you get this crazy flip where suddenly, oh no, it's the women that are the more moral, the angels of the house, the ones who have this, they're just like naturally less sinful. So that's what's super weird, is that flip in the 19th century from being more sinful than men to being less sinful than men. And really, neither one is true, right? Like all of us are sinful. Right. All of us have our moments of faithfully following Jesus. So yeah, but that's the wider culture piece that's actually connected more to like industrialization and men being out there in the dirty public sphere, having to do business and politics. Whereas women, you know, because we have these separate spheres of work now in the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution, women are seen as being the moral upholders of good household life. And so the men can come away from that dirty public sector and be in this more protected, sanctified home that the woman presides over. But that's not until the 19th century. Every time before that, both men and women are kind of interacting in the public and the private sphere. There's much more cottage industry. There's much more farming, people just interacting within the household and within the towns.
So it's the cultural shift really that drives some of that, like the industrialization, like you said, as opposed to like everybody's just chilling at the house all the time, right? Like,
And it would be fair to say it's also an economic shift because that ideal of the angel of the house and the man out in the public sphere really only applied to a small portion of society, but it became this idealized, romanticized notion of what it ought to be like for everyone, even though it wasn't necessarily achievable for very many people.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. The only angels of the house that we're talking about are the upper class white women.
Right.
In any of the other societies, the other people are still seen in that Aristotelian, like lower, more sinful, less rational, more emotional. So it's only those, it's only those upper class white women that even have the capacity to reach that angel of the house status in the 19th century. But we have to talk about Martin Luther because I jumped ahead and I want to go back to Let's go back to Reformation, because there still is important shift in Reformation, for sure. And Martin Luther used to be my favorite. Like, I did a job interview one time and somebody's like, who's your favorite theologian? You know, and I said Martin Luther, and largely because he finally valued the work that women had been doing in the home. Like, he really, and men in the home, like women and men as fathers and mothers and wives and husbands. You know, we've talked about how the celibate ideal was so strong in the first 1400-1500 years of the church. And so for Martin Luther to come along and say, wow, this work of parenting that parents are doing is truly godly, beautiful work. So he was my favorite theologian for a while. But then he, of course, had to say all these negative things about celibacy. Like, come on, Martin Luther, can't you just be happy to celebrate the home and the celibate lifestyle? But no, I mean, he and his wife are a former monk and a former nun getting married, and they're distinguishing their vision of Christianity from this previous vision of Christianity that they were a part of. And so he comes to disparage celibacy, and then so much of the tradition after him comes to disparage celibacy. So that's when then I'm like, okay, great. Now you're not my favorite theologian.
So, he did have the whole anti-Semitism thing too going
on. And there's that too.
And there's that.
Yes.
It's interesting as we're talking about these, how people seem to like to jump from one extreme to the other, right? Like the women as carnal to suddenly women are angels. And the celibacy is the best thing to all of a sudden celibacy is the worst thing, and marriage is the best thing. And it's like we struggle to have a more holistic, integrated view of things. We just gravitate a little bit towards the, maybe they're simpler or maybe they're more extreme. I'm not sure. But I think we as humans struggle with that tendency.
I mean, it makes sense. And Luther's like throwing off the bounds of like having to had lived that celibate life, right? And he's like, overcorrecting, and in the same way, the Catholic Church counter reforms, right, and overcorrects towards that way, you know, whatever way it is. I don't know which way, but you know,
And to be fair, Luther was looking at all the bad things that he saw in that system, and so those were the things he was focused on, right? So it's understandable, but at the same time, now looking back, it feels like a loss. Like we lost some of the good stuff that was still there in trying to correct.
So Luther pretty much makes it to where like the ideal is marriage then for the woman. And like in that system, she is sort of whole.
Yeah. So women lost the option of singleness as a vocational calling to ministry. And the only calling then became marriage and motherhood.
That was a piece that I thought was so interesting, Leanne, in your original presentation that you gave that led to this whole book. Because you were basically showing how, like, so many times one option for serving in the church gets shut down. And then another option, like, arises for women. And so kind of in that original presentation, she had noticed, okay, Protestants don't have any place for single women until the missionary movement. And then suddenly, gradually,
but then gradually,
there is a place for single women.
So what time period are we talking about when that shift then happens?
When the single women start becoming, having a vocation again?
Yeah.
Oh gosh, we're talking like post-Civil War.
Okay.
So the modern missionary movement started in the late 1700s. And originally the mission agencies would only send married couples to the field. Okay. So a woman who had a call to mission had to find a husband. So she would often, the woman would have the call to mission, couldn't get to the field by herself. So she had to find a husband who had the call, and then she could go along as his partner. And so that was the model for 50, 60 years. But what happened was the women would get to the field and they would find that life was really hard, right? Much harder than at home. And so between taking care of children and trying to figure out how to do the laundry and get food and all these other things, they would see all these needs around them where they wanted to engage as missionaries and they were exhausted. They just didn't have enough capacity to do it all. So married women started sending letters home to their friends saying, hey, send us some single women. We need some single women. They'll have more time to put into the work. And the agencies, the organizations were kind of resistant. They weren't sure that sending single women was a good idea. So at some point, the women's societies got together and they said, well, we'll raise the money and we'll just send the women by ourselves. And this launched an entire movement that lasted for about 50 years of women sending organizations, where women across denominationally would come together and listen to speakers and raise money and send out an educator or a nurse or a doctor to an area where she could have both that practical ministry and be an evangelist. And it was just really cool to watch how that mushroomed really from the post-Civil War right up into the early part of the 20th century.
Those societal shifts are just intriguing, right? And I think a lot of Protestants have a very short memory for how things ought to be, right? Mm-hmm. I think a lot, when I'm looking out in this sort of world, it's like, whatever we've been doing for the last like 40 or 50 years is like the ideal. And that's how it has always been in our minds. And that's how it always should be, right? And I think like learning history and how these things have shifted over time, like should humble us a little bit, right? And like teach us that like Christians have done this in so many different ways throughout the years, and all these things can be faithful at the same time, right?
And that was a core message we were trying to show, wasn't it, Annika, that there are many, many, many ways women can be faithful and live out their calling. And it doesn't just look like one thing or another thing, but that God has called women to do all kinds of things throughout history, and that all of them can be models for today.
Yeah.
I think especially because we get really frustrated or sad when we see people that feel trapped in those environments where there's that only that one vision. Because of, Curry, what you were saying, like that the history of memory for this particular denomination or church or organization, like they've only seen women do it this way or men do it this way. So for us to be able to share, like our vision is to hopefully set other people free to see that there's been other people that they can look to as models in other times and places, even if their own community that they're a part of doesn't really have celibate women or doesn't really have evangelist women. You know, they can see, well, the church writ large has, you know, there could be a place for you.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I know this is like such a flyover overview of your book, which can't even come close to doing it justice. Is there some like piece of this that we've missed and just sort of like something that you definitely think like we need to talk about, a story, a part of this whole thing that we skipped over?
It's hard to narrow it down, isn't it? I wondered if you wanted to talk about one of the reformers, but I definitely think we should talk about a few of the big picture patterns that we saw. Because as we got to the end of this, back at the beginning, you said, and you just said now, it's hard to fit it into a quick conversation. Well, we had a really hard time figuring out what to fit into this book and what to leave out, right? Because there was so much more. And we kept intentionally reminding ourselves, no, we're not going deep. We're giving the big picture view. We're trying to paint this picture for 2,000 years of how women have been involved and how God has called women, which means that we couldn't go into depth on many, many things that are interesting. But it does on the flip side, and now allow us to see patterns that have repeated throughout the course of history. And those maybe are some of the, for me anyway, some of the biggest takeaways from this project.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. I'd love to hear about that.
So one of the first ones that we saw, and we're not the first to point this out, but we saw it over and over again, is that as things are getting started, women seem to be welcomed. So as the church is starting in the New Testament, women are, they're deacons, they're widows, they're patrons, they're hosting house churches, they're delivering letters, they're doing all these things. But then as the works or as the movements become more established, and often as they try to become more respectable in the eyes of society, that's when women start getting pushed out to the margins. It's that pattern just shows up over and over again. Same thing in the monastic movements. Women were some of the early ones in the desert, set up some of the early houses for monastics. But then later, as monastics became more accepted and monasteries got more power and more wealth and more recognition, that's when it started being a time for pushing women to the margins and saying, oh, no, you can't lead this. Oh, no, you can't be the abbess. We need a man in charge, right? Yeah. And again, same thing with the mission movement that I was talking about a minute ago. The women formed those societies, but when those societies became very successful, the men started voting to take them back over, right? And so women kind of, you can see the pattern as women losing, or you can see the pattern, as Annika said earlier, of each time women lose one area, God seems to open a door for them somewhere else. So that's another pattern, right, of continuous new opportunities for women.
Since Curry mentioned theology earlier, I thought you might appreciate just the highlighting of several ways that women have contributed to theological developments over the years. And we've highlighted them as we've gone along, but I'd love to just highlight them again now. So one, as martyrs, and so shaping a theology of suffering, shaping a theology of what does it look like to follow Christ. But then also those medieval mystics, their visions of Jesus as an infant or as a grown man, they actually helped to shift medieval piety away from kind of the high kingly view of Jesus and more towards the appreciation of Christ's humanity and his bodily suffering. And so I think when you think about how have women impacted theology, you have to remember a lot of it is not sitting down to write a theological treatise that now we can go and find on our shelf, but it's more the lived theology, providing an example for people to look to. But then also those women in the mission movement, a theology of Christian home life. This was an important piece that they brought and that Indigenous Christians in various areas have continued. And what's interesting there is it's often both men and women, you know, figuring this out together. So missionary women led the way in thinking about what does Christian home life look like. But then from there, Indigenous Christians in China and in India and elsewhere in the 1900s were figuring that out. So I think that's another important piece, recognizing that women have contributed to theology along the way. And also recognizing that men have looked to women and have learned from them. Just as much as women have looked to women to learn from them. I think for my mind and my eye, I was just very drawn as a woman to look at past women as examples to help me in my life. But it was actually Lynn Kohick, as she was reading one of our drafts early on, she's like, yes, but you also have to realize that men were listening to the stories of women and men were also listening to women's stories and learning from them. And so I think that's an important point to make as well, especially, you know, if there's a pastor out there that reads our book and is like, you know, thinking about telling one of these stories of women, we don't just tell these stories to inspire other women. We tell these stories about women to inspire men and women, just like women can listen to stories about men and be inspired by them. So I think that was an important thing I learned doing this as well.
Yeah. Let's get these dudes reading about women. Come on.
That's right.
It's good. I love it.
Thanks for your help with that.
I think it's important. Yeah. I just even think like incorporating, like pastors incorporating more of that into the teaching, right? Like, So I think that's really important stuff. And, I think what y'all did, what y'all have is great work, and, I really, appreciate it. So I would love to talk about the two final questions with both of y'all, if that is okay. Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Okay. So when I was in seminary, I worked for a dermatologist office as a receptionist to make money. And this will tell you how old I am. They were doing drug trials of Rogaine for men's hair growth. And I had to bring the patient in, find the little tattoo on their head, shave, mark out that square, shave it, and then go put each piece of hair that came out of their little test square on a glassine card and glue it down and count how many they had. And I had to do this with we were taking 50 patients for like a year. Every month they would come in and I would have to find this little square and cut the hairs and lay them on the little slide.
Oh my goodness.
It was interesting.
Did you know that was going to be part of the job when you signed up for it?
No. I thought I was going to be answering the phone.
Wow.
Seems like what? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool. That's good. I love that.
Is that weird enough for you?
That's a great one. That's a great one.
I don't have anything weird to offer. I mean, the one that comes to my mind is not like weird, but it's like just unexpected and beautiful and sweet. And it was in high school, and I grew up playing piano. I've played piano forever. And we were on this Europe trip. You know, my parents were kind enough. I don't know what ever entered their head, but they sent me as a high schooler on a Europe trip with a bunch of other high schoolers. But we ended up at this, up in the Alps, in this tiny little country church. And I saw a little advertisement like, any pianists or organists, you know, we need someone for our Sunday service. And so I told my little leader, and she found the priest for that little church. And I played the organ up at this mountain church up in the Alps. They didn't pay me for it. I don't know if it still counts as a job, but I remember just being so excited and nervous. But then, of course, like all my fellow high schoolers, you know, none of which are Christian, but they all came to support me in this cute little church up in the Alps. And so we all celebrated a service together. Yeah.
That's like idyllic.
I know it is. Awesome. It's like opposite of Leanne's.
it balances out. I feel like it's good. It's awesome. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
What's been super helpful for me, we talk a lot in the Honors College here at Indiana Wesleyan about a sacramental ontology. So just, you know, realizing that like every moment of your day is an opportunity to be connecting with God. So for me, the way this played out recently, I was really frustrated because my brother was here visiting and I didn't get to hang out with everybody because my youngest child like was really needy, but like I'm a mom. And so my work is being a mom, but I was all frustrated with him. For taking me away from my brother who was visiting. And then all of a sudden, like my mind just like shifted. And it was like God just wanting me to see his presence in that moment. And all of a sudden I was just overwhelmed with my son's beauty and the way in which God was present to me in that son on that one particular day. My students, when I talk about this stuff with them, they're like, yeah, that's overwhelming. Like I can't be like mindful literally every moment of my day. Like, yeah, I know. But if there's just like several times in a day or several times in a week where you can be, I think it's super helpful to just bring God into your work day. But I don't know what that looks like for individual people. That's just what it looks like for me.
I wonder if it looks different if you're in a Christian environment and a secular environment. Like Annika and I both have the blessing of being in a Christian environment where we can freely and openly talk about these things as much as we want. At the same time, that can make you take it for granted, right? Whereas if you're in a secular environment, maybe you need to be a little more alert and a little more perhaps thinking about how you are in that space, how you're behaving, how your behavior is coming across, how your actions and your words are impacting people, but maybe you're less direct about it. But I think all of it, you know, we're whole people. And one thing I like about some of the postmodern shifts in our society is that it has opened that space for spirituality and faith to be an accepted thing that we talk about in many venues, right? Okay. So I can go to a secular conference and talk about how faith impacts the lives of women leaders. And they're like, oh yeah, we want to hear this, right? So I think we have opportunities that we can take advantage of even in those secular spaces if we're paying attention and if we're willing. I don't know if that answers your question. But.
No, I love that. I love that. I think that's great. Annika, Leanne, it was such a pleasure getting to hang out with y'all and talk about your amazing work. And I just thank you for making time for me and coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, if you couldn't tell, I highly recommend Women in the Mission of the Church. It's a powerful read. I think you're going to love it. I hope you just learn something a little more about the history of women in this episode. I hope it encouraged you to find out more, too. I think that's an important part of all this is teaching ourselves and learning and getting out of those normal modes of thinking that we have. And so, yeah, read some history, and I hope you appreciate it. This is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review for me there. It just helps get the word out about the podcast. Lets me know you're listening. That is always greatly appreciated. I appreciate you doing that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.